Okay, let's get with it. Please keep in mind that throughout this two-hour special, we welcome your contributions to KBMR FM at 265-9555 or 1-877-355-5867. Kevin, do we have you on the line?
Sure do.
Excellent. Kevin Barrett, Ph.D., before we get into things, why don't you briefly tell us what your qualifications are to give us the information you're going to give us this afternoon?
I'll make it short.
Please.
I have a Ph.D. in African languages and literature, and my field of concentration is in Arabic and Islamic studies. So I've been paying attention to what's happening over in the Islamic world for quite some time, and I started paying even more attention after 9/11 and the wars it triggered.
Okay. Before we get into that, as I was looking over some of the literature that you sent me, a couple of things jumped out at me, and I'd like to cover them quickly. One of the things was Jim Fetzler is single-handedly responsible for getting Jesse Ventura on board with the JFK Truth. What is your perspective on the JFK Truth?
The truth of the JFK assassination, of course, is that it obviously was not done by a lone nut named Lee Harvey Oswald, a communist who, it turns out, had been working for the FBI and had been sent over to the Soviet Union on a dissenter program for the CIA. He actually... I just got back to my phone. Basically, the truth of JFK assassination is that corrupt elements in our own government, along with some organized crime elements, were involved in that assassination.
Okay. Just for my own curiosity, are you familiar with a man named James Files and his confession?
I believe I've heard of him, yeah. Wasn't he the guy who got himself jailed? He shot up a bank or something? Wasn't that him?
No. James Files confessed to being the shooter on the grassy knoll.
Oh, okay. No, I don't know about that.
Okay, so you and I can discuss that off-air because I think it's going to fascinate you. Another thing to cover quickly, and that is Russ Baker. He has a book, Family of Secrets, and it includes extensive evidence implicating George H.W. Bush in the JFK assassination. Can you tell us briefly about that?
That's right. Yeah, Russ Baker's book, Family of Secrets, is a must-read for anybody who wants to understand our real history of the past several decades. It's a good book to read alongside the book of Jim Douglas, which is called JFK and the Unspeakable. Douglas's book gives a really good overview of the way corrupt forces in the military-industrial complex focused on the CIA killed JFK.
Okay.
Yeah.
So how was George H.W. Bush involved in the JFK assassination?
Well, that's kind of a long story, and you'd probably be better off bringing Russ Baker on to give you the full details. But to make a long story short is that George H.W. Bush was working for the CIA. He had an oil company called Zapata Petroleum, which was actually a CIA front. It didn't have anything much to do with actually drilling for oil or trading in oil. It was a way to get CIA people into hot spots around the world. And one of those hot spots was Cuba. Bush was overseeing one group of the CIA-trained Cuban exiles that were trying to overthrow Castro. When Kennedy torpedoed the Bay of Pigs invasion, which had been designed to take out Castro with a U.S. military invasion, they didn't tell Kennedy that he was supposed to send in the military, so it turned into a fiasco. Kennedy then fired Allen Dulles, head of the CIA. And from that moment on, there was serious bad blood between JFK and people like George H.W. Bush in the CIA who were trying to get rid of Castro. The actual evidence against Bush is that he has repeatedly made lies and dissimulations about where he actually was on November 22, 1963. And as Russ Baker points out in his book, Family of Secrets, Bush was in Dallas that morning. Then he flew out of Dallas, touched down. Where was it? Another Texas town, gave a little speech to the Chamber of Commerce to establish an alibi, and then called up the FBI and fingered a member of his Young Republican Club as a possible suspect in the JFK assassination, thereby wasting the FBI's time. And Bush lied about all of this. He's actually claimed he doesn't even remember where he was on November 22nd, 1963. I guess that's probably good enough for now. Bring on Baker for the rest.
Okay. Fine. I want to remind listeners, this is a pledge drive show. You're welcome to phone in at any time. If what we're talking about is so interesting that you don't feel like breaking your continuity, then after the show, when you do phone in your pledge, please mention this show as being a reason for phoning in. From the previous show, we want to thank Lisa Russell, Liza, of Alta, California. And we also want to thank Robin Kleinhaus. Thanks to both of you very much. Okay, Kevin, your most recent book, it's called Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama Voters. Why did you write this book for Obama voters?
People who voted for Obama, by and large, did so because they have hope. He inspired them with hope for the future in a very dark time under Bush and Cheney. And many Obama voters hoped that Obama would put an end to the so-called war on terror initiated by Bush and Cheney. And even those who weren't quite so set in their opinions were hoping, I think, that something would change and basically distrusting the whole story of the war on terror that we got from Bush and Cheney. So Obama voters are ready for the truth about what's really been going on post 9/11 and, of course, on 9/11 itself. But I think they have to be led along gently. So I wrote my book explicitly to sort of start off with things that we can all agree on, such as the fact that you are 30 times more likely to be hit by lightning than to be killed by a terrorist. So why does the media make you fear terrorism? And then moving on slowly through all of the evidence that these wars in Afghanistan and Iraq have nothing to do with fighting terror, all the way to the evidence suggesting that 9/11, like the JFK assassination, was orchestrated by forces on our own side.
Okay, and we'll get into that later in the show. Just to let listeners know, the policy of KVMR is when you do make a donation, we like to thank you, and we like to thank you in a material way. So the thank you gifts for this particular show are several books by Kevin Barrett, who's our guest right now. One of them is Questioning the War on Terror for a $60 pledge. Another one is Truth Jihad, and we're going to talk about both of those books later in the show. That's also for a $60 pledge. And then he also has a DVD, Naturae Carta, Jews Against Zionism, and that's for a $60 pledge. You can get both books in the CD and the DVD for a $150 pledge. And then when you phone in your pledge, please ask our phone answers, because there's something about us working in coordination with the food banks of various counties. They'll explain that to you. I think we got kind of crazy. We've got so many gifts that we can offer you that you should really talk to the phone answers about that. One of the most interesting things is if you want to become an angel and give us a $365 pledge, that's only a dollar a day, you can be a broadcaster for an hour, and you can be a broadcaster on this show. If you're tired of listening to me rabble-rouse and you want to do your own rabble-rousing for an hour, for $365 pledge, you can come in here and you can have an hour. So you can talk to the phone answers about that as well. And then, of course, if you want to be a really good Samaritan and just make a donation and no gift is you don't need a gift, then we're certainly happy to have that. Okay, Kevin, you'll have to forgive me, but we're going to have to interrupt in order to do this pledge drive. So anybody that wants to phone in a pledge, you're welcome to do so. 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. Okay, Kevin, next one. If we're not really in Iraq and Afghanistan to fight terrorism, why are we there?
That's a good question, and if you sit down and, you know, look at the geopolitics from a realist perspective and, you know, read people like Brzezinski, he says Afghanistan is the center of the grand chessboard. He points out that the continent of Eurasia contains the majority of human and natural resources, and that whoever dominates
Translate oil.
Yeah, like, right. Oil is a very big part of that, but there's a lot of other things there, too. So he says whoever dominates the center of the Eurasian continent will win the great game of superpower rivalries to dominate the world. And Afghanistan is right there at the exact center of the grand chessboard. That's why one of the big reasons for invading Afghanistan must have been to establish military bases there. And secondly, there's a gas pipeline that was in the works before 9/11, and the year before 9/11, the Taliban took it away from Unocal, which is the government, U.S. government-supported U.S. energy company of Condoleezza Rice and
I think your slip of the tongue was exactly right. Unocal is the government in Afghanistan now.
Pretty much, yeah. Well, them and the CIA heroin syndicate.
Right.
And that was the other reason for invading, was that Afghanistan has been the world's largest opium producer and therefore is, you know, responsible for most of the world's heroin produced. Since the CIA moved production from Southeast Asia, where they had kept it going and controlled it during the Vietnam era, to Afghanistan. And the Taliban had shut down the opium crop and thereby put a huge crimp in the supply line of heroin around the world, and more importantly, put a huge crimp in the supply line of dirty money around the world. That dirty money is used by the Wall Street CIA, you know, what do we call them, the WASP Corleone Syndicate, which the Bush family is right up at the top, to keep the world financial system going, or rather keep the U.S.-British domination of the world financial system going. They take all this cash from the drug money, and that gets up to, you know, $1.5 trillion per year in dirty money has to be laundered. And then they launder it through banks and corporations, which they choose. So not only are they making a huge pile of money moving this money around, but then they're also able to invest in the stock market. And for instance, if this year we're going to put a couple hundred billion into General Electric, that's going to show up as earnings on GE's report, and that means their stock's going to go up. Everybody's going to think GE had a good year. Now, the people in the know are going to buy the GE stock before they put the drug money into the company, and then they're going to sell afterwards, and they keep doing this as sort of a dirty money shell game.
It's called pump and dump, I believe.
Indeed it is.
Okay.
So getting that heroin back on the market was probably the biggest single reason for invading Afghanistan.
Oh, okay, even more so than the pipeline.
Yeah, I mean, because that's what they did. They invaded and they instantly freed all the drug lords, set them to work, encouraged opium planting, and within a year and a half, they were back at the biggest pre-Hamid Karzai levels. And within 3 years, they were way, way past any levels of opium production in the past. And currently, they're setting new records every year. So they succeeded at that, whereas the gas pipeline is a much slower project. It's really not coming along very well. So based on the results of the invasion, you'd have to say that the thing that they cared most about was restoring the opium crop.
Mm-hmm. I'm sure you're aware of this, but our listeners might not be. And that is, Hamid Karzai's relatives are drug warlords, and the guy that's running against him, the good guy if you consider Hamid Karzai the bad guy, he's a drug warlord.
It's a drug regime, and in fact, you know, you can argue that the Taliban are about the only real players in Afghanistan with any shred of morality or ethics. Now, there are certain kinds of morality and ethics that can be carried too far, like when they're blowing up Buddha statues and, you know, preventing women from getting treated by male doctors and crazy stuff like that.
Mm-hmm.
But at least they've got a code of ethics, which is more than you can say for the rest of them.
Good point. Okay, so that explains why we're in Afghanistan, and why do you think we went to Iraq?
In Iraq, I think oil was a much bigger factor, and so was the national interest of the State of Israel. As you probably know, Israel has been dominated by extreme right-wing forces for more than a decade now, and some would say there's not that much difference between the extremists and the rest of the Israeli policymakers. They're all pretty extreme. And in order to keep flouting the United Nations orders that they go back to their 67 borders, and allow the Palestinian refugees to return to the land from which they were ethnically cleansed, the Israelis have a very, very aggressive kind of foreign policy, and they're always at war with their neighbors. And their biggest enemy prior to 9/11 was Saddam Hussein, who was funding suicide bombers and otherwise helping the Palestinian resistance. Now, Israeli doctrine has been to try to break up the surrounding nations into smaller pieces that will be less threatening. And there's actually a document called the Clean Break Document that was drawn up for Netanyahu back in 1995, 1996 by people like Richard Perle and others who showed up later in the Bush administration. And this document says what we need to do to redraw the map of the Middle East in the favor of Israel is to first have regime change in Iraq and try to break the country up into three pieces and then move on to Iran. And that's what they tried to do. So I actually think the biggest reason for invading Iraq was Israeli geostrategy, not oil, because Saddam was willing to play ball. He was willing to sell us all the oil we could buy. There was really no good reason to justify the expenditure of that kind of resources on oil.
What do you know of the story that Saddam was about to transfer his oil profits into euros rather than dollars, and that frightened the international bankers?
Well, it wasn't so much his profits, but he was selling oil in euros. He was getting around the sanctions and selling in euros.
But my point was that he was transferring the hegemony of the dollar and transferring that over to the euro, and that was threatening the stability of the dollar. And I've heard that that was another reason for invading Afghanistan, Iraq.
Well, that makes sense to me. He certainly was selling in euros. That may have been a threat to the hegemony of the dollar, although we're seeing the dollar tanking now and being... the dollar is in worse shape now than it was then. If indeed that was one of the motives for the invasion, it sure backfired, because now the U.S. is hated everywhere. There's this gigantic alliance against us, against the dollar, made up of, apparently, according to Robert Fisk, Saudi Arabia, Iran, all the Gulf states, Russia, China, France, for goodness sake. And that kind of alliance against the dollar is something much more serious than just Saddam Hussein selling his oil in euros.
Okay. Let me remind listeners that where else on the radio dial are you going to hear shows of this nature? You know the answer to that. KVMR is an extremely unique radio station. We broadcast worldwide over the web, and this is your chance to support us. You've been listening. This is your chance to pay us back. And by pay us back, you're just supporting the station. Almost all of the broadcasters are volunteer broadcasters. You're just helping keep the station on the air. Now's your chance to help. 265-9555 and 1-800-355-5867. So, this is your chance to phone in. Okay, Kevin, why are U.S. forces attacking Pakistan?
I suppose to destabilize Pakistan. I mean, the official reason that they give us, and they tell us this in the mainstream media all the time, is that Pakistan is supposedly providing a safe haven for those evil terrorists associated with the evil Taliban, yada, yada, yada. But that really is a very dubious excuse, because we've been messing with Pakistan, and actually it appears that U.S. or perhaps even more obviously British forces have, to some extent, supported some of these rebel factions in Pakistan. In fact, the U.S. is supporting a lot of rebel factions in various parts of Pakistan. If you add all of this up, it appears that what's really going on here is that the U.S. is trying to destabilize Pakistan, partly to punish it for getting too close to China. Pakistan is an ally of China's against India. And secondly, to mess with Pakistan, to disempower it by destabilizing it, to prevent Pakistan from being a strong and stable nuclear power, which once again is seen as very threatening by the Israelis. And then also to break off the oil-rich and gas-rich province of Baluchistan from the rest of Pakistan so that that province can be more easily exploited by the big oil companies.
Let us keep in mind that historically Kuwait was once a province of Iraq, and the big oil companies managed to split off Kuwait. So what you're talking about now is a recreation of history.
Excellent point. That's a very, very good point. Nobody in the U.S. ever seemed to hear this in the mainstream media, that the Iraqis actually have a very good argument that Kuwait is a province of Iraq. It always had been historically. And like you say, it was set up as a sort of a puppet sheikdom by the British, so the British could more easily control that oil. And this is a general kind of strategy of the big imperial powers. They want to break up other countries into little pieces that can be more easily managed. And this strategy isn't changing now under Obama.
Yeah, and let's also keep in mind that this whole idea that these were countries in the first place, that was only a creation after World War One. So these supposed countries were cobbled together after the breakup of the Ottoman Empire, and so anybody's claim to any of this territory is kind of dubious.
That's a good point. And in fact, a lot of so-called radical Muslims say that since a lot of this territory used to be part of the Ottoman Empire, which was a caliphate, that is, it was ruled supposedly on behalf of God according to the instructions of Islamic tradition.
Wait a minute. Don't all rulers claim that they're
pretty much
being supported by God?
Pretty much. And so if you're looking at it from a terrestrial perspective rather than a celestial one,
okay,
then you have to kind of decide, you know, based on what people think. You know, do people accept this as legitimate? And in Islamic land, people are very much prone to accepting governments as legitimate based on Islamic criteria. And so this Ottoman Empire, which was a self-declared caliphate, that is, the caliph is the successor, rather the sort of deputy or successor to the Prophet Muhammad, peace upon him, the first sort of lawgiver, person who that God revealed the laws for, right? So this makes it more legitimate in the eyes of the people there. And when the caliphate or the Ottoman Empire was broken up by the European powers after World War One into these artificial nation states, that left a certain void of legitimacy that's still there. And that's why groups like Al-Qaeda are able to use the call for a more legitimate Islamic order to oppose the governments of these artificial nation states.
Uh-huh. Yeah, I know. I lived in Afghanistan for a while. And when I was in Afghanistan, this was before the Soviet invasion, when I was there, everybody was very clear that there was no central government. It was simply that the prince in Kabul had the most rifles.
Well, that's pretty much it. And, of course, this is how many kinds of government have been down through the years. And there's something to be said for that kind of government because they don't mess with ordinary people very much.
No, they don't.
In Morocco, the Sultan claimed lands that he could reach on campaigns to collect taxes. And those campaigns were limited by how many different places he could visit with his henchmen in a certain amount of time. So that's what the borders were. And, of course, most people, if they really wanted to avoid interference in their lives from the government, all they had to do was just pay their taxes when the king and his henchmen came around. Or if you didn't want to do that, then you just sort of make yourself scarce when they come around and hope they don't burn your property.
Right.
But yeah, those of us who are not enthralled with having the government monitoring every little bit of our lives can look back to days like that and say, you know, it'd be, in some ways, it would be nice to go back to something a little bit more like that.
Yeah, and also the highway robbery by government was more obvious. It was more blatant.
Right. Now the government pretends to be your friend.
Yes.
They blow up the World Trade Center, murder 3,000 people, and then they come in and shred the Constitution and start spying on you and throwing you in prison without trial, without habeas corpus, and all of this is to protect you.
Okay, we're going to get into 9/11 and your perspective on that a little later in the program, but I want to remind listeners it's 12:25 in the p.m. 30. Let's go for that. It's 12:30 in the p.m. You're listening to KVMR FM, broadcasting out of Nevada City, California. Your host is Chamba Lane. The name of the show is Rabble Rousing. Our guest is Kevin Barrett. And this is going to go on for another hour and a half. This is a pledge drive special. This is your time to support KVMR. We support you 365 days a year. This is your chance to pay back the favor. We have some very capable phone answers, so please phone in with your pledge. 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867, and we want to thank Paul Patterson for a very generous donation. Okay.
Hey, great going, Paul. Thank you.
Yes, thank you. You named an earlier, one of the books that we're offering as a premium is a book you wrote called Truth Jihad, and that's also your website. I'm kind of curious about the name. Doesn't jihad have a negative connotation? Why'd you name it that?
Well, I named the book Truth Jihad first, and that was before I had that website. And I chose that title because my book is an attempt to bring some comedy to the whole topic of 9/11 and what's happened to the country since 9/11, which is, of course, the most grim topic you could ever imagine. It's so grim that it needs a little comic relief to make it bearable. And I've been, you know, doing some kind of offbeat comedy around some of these things before, and so I decided to do a sort of a self-mocking autobiography of how a nice Midwestern white boy became a crazed, radical Muslim 9/11 truth activist, or conspiracy theorist, as they call it. It's sort of a parody of Don Quixote, too. You know, those of us who are trying to reveal the truth of 9/11 are engaged in a very quixotic task.
I'll say.
So this truth jihad is not meant entirely seriously. It's partly a self-parody just trying to poke fun at my own all-out quest for the truth. But at the same time, it really is an all-out quest for the truth, and it is a form of jihad. In Islam, jihad means struggle. And the first meaning of jihad is the struggle to be a better person, inner struggle. And, of course, being a good person is a struggle because we're all faced with all kinds of temptations. It's so much easier to not be such a good person so much of the time. So it is a struggle. And that's the main form of jihad. That's what Prophet Muhammad, according to one disputed hadith, called the greater jihad. And then the lesser jihad means defense of the Islamic community. And that defense could come from anything. It could be through using your tongue. It could be through using your pen or your word processor or your computer, and it could be through going out and actually physically fighting. And since I'm kind of out of shape for physically fighting, and it's not my thing anyway, I'm actually more of a peacemaker kind of guy, I thought I would do my all-out defense of the Islamic community through trying to reveal the truth about 9/11 in a more peaceful and humorous form.
Okay. One of the greatest challenges for anybody that disbelieves the government's conspiracy theory about 9/11. One of the greatest challenges is trying to convince friends and relatives. Do you feel like your book, Truth Jihad, would be a useful tool in that endeavor?
Well, I wanted it to be. I figured that since we conspiracy theorists are always being portrayed in the media as a bunch of extremely self-righteous, serious prigs, who are,
okay.
That's all we ever talk about, and of course it's true. Once you figure this out, it's hard,
you want
to talk about it.
It's hard not to try and spread the word.
Right, but then from the perspective of somebody who doesn't get it, you look like you're a kind of a cultist. You look kind of obsessed, and often you look too serious, like you look really grim, and it is a grim topic that mm-hmm. this was an inside job. It's horrible. So I thought that by writing a sort of a humorous autobiography, here's confessions of a 9/11 truth activist. Read this, and you'll see that I'm not a prig or a cultist or someone lacking a sense of humor. And you'll maybe be able to get into the whole topic through that angle. And I'm not sure it worked so well, but I think in a way that how many people are really ready to have their assumptions about the world challenged at so many levels at once, and then how many people have the same warped sort of Frank Zappa-esque or Samuel Beckett-esque sense of humor that I have. I think I kind of limited my audience there, but I think it worked fine for some people.
Mm-hmm.
My new book, though, which is called Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama Voters, I think is actually more effective at bringing ordinary non-9/11 truther Obama voters on board with 9/11 truth. I test marketed this on my own relatives. I have some relatives who are liberal, Democrat, idealistic, reasonably well informed by the standards of today's USA, which isn't saying much. But
they look at something besides Fox News.
Indeed, they certainly do.
Okay.
They read The Nation and things like that.
Mm-hmm.
But they don't get 9/11. That's just a little more than they can digest. And so I've been working on these people for years over the dinner table and any chance I get. And finally, with this book, I showed it to them as I was writing it and got their responses. And they were all pretty enthralled with Obama. And so what I had to do was rewrite the book a few times and tone down the challenges to Obama. I had to give Obama a lot of the benefit of the doubt. That was just one kind of change I made. But after this fine-tuning process was over, I had a book that I could hand to these very relatives And they read it all the way through and loved it and basically agreed with it, and including agreeing with the last third of the book, which is talking about false flag operations in general and the 9/11 false flag operation in particular.
So I think
it was, so it's a very, and I've heard this from other people too, it's a really good book to give to left-leaning Obama voters who aren't quite yet on board with 9/11 truth.
Okay, so there you have it, folks. For a contribution of $60, you can obtain your own copy of that book, Questioning the War on Terror, by Kevin Barrett. And if you want a more humorous treatment, then there's Truth Jihad. But both of those may serve you in spreading the word, which is important. And you get those by making a contribution to KVMR by phoning 265-9555 or 1-877-355-5867.
Well, you know, Shamba, the truth is precious, and the ability to speak hard truth in public through the media is extremely precious and rare these days. And I think your listeners must appreciate your show being one of the very few kinds of, you know, reasonably, you know, you're not just internet-based, and yet you're telling these hard truths that are hardly ever told anymore except on the internet. And this is really priceless, and I would hope that they would kick in a few bucks to keep you going.
Okay, thank you for that. Before we get into 9/11, what you have been following the Muslim perspective from around the world. What is the Muslim perspective on the American war in Iraq and Afghanistan?
Well, not surprisingly, Muslims oppose these wars and believe pretty overwhelmingly that 9/11 was, well, it wasn't what we were told. The polls show that about 80% of the Muslims around the world and 60% of American Muslims believe that 9/11 was not committed by Arab hijackers. So that's, and you know, and I was shocked at this. When 9/11 happened, I assumed that the official story was more or less true. At that point, I couldn't imagine that they would have fabricated such an event in the way they did. So I was pretty shocked that so many of my Muslim friends here in Madison, Wisconsin, instantly thought it was an inside job. That was their first impression, was this is obviously not what they're telling us. And so for 2 years, I was pretty much the only Muslim around that actually more or less believed the official story. So that gives you a sense of how the perspective differs somewhat, even, you know, here in the USA among educated, middle-class, pretty calm, conservative, mellow Muslims, as opposed to the average Americans who are not Muslims. And as far as the wars go, of course, most Muslims have access to other media, and of course to the general attitudes of, you know, people talking in the community. And so the, you know, the overall attitude is that what we're facing here is a war on Islam. And yet most Muslims, certainly in the U.S., but even around the world, are not, inclined to want to take up arms against this war on Islam. They're, for whatever reason, I think they're more, hoping that it'll sort of blow over. Personally, I wish Muslims would get more active. I mean, they almost all understand that this is a gigantic injustice that's being perpetrated. But as with other communities, only a small minority are activists willing to stick their necks out to do something about it.
Is that why Muslims don't seem to be very visible in the 9/11 truth movement?
I think so, yeah. My friend, Dr. Faz Khan, who's a, he was an imam at a mosque on Long Island, and he was a first responder on 9/11. At that time, he was working at Jewish Hospital of Long Island, and he rushed to the scene and was involved in the triage there. And he's a really good guy, a very smart guy. He was actually the main Muslim for 9/11 Truth for the first couple of years. And then I kind of took the baton from him at some point after I figured it out. And he points out in this essay that he wrote for one of my earlier books, the book I edited called 9/11 and the American Empire, Volume 2, Christians, Jews, and Muslims Speak Out, he argued that the Muslim community has dropped the ball on 9/11 for a number of reasons. And one of them is that many Muslims are, you know, first or second generation and still feel a bit uneasy in the American political system. They are not comfortable with being able to just say whatever they think in public, with, you know, in many of the countries where these people come from, if you speak the truth about the dark secrets of the government, you're likely to be disappeared.
Right.
So they are not quite yet in the mindset of a patriotic American citizen defending constitutional liberties. Of course, many are, but for so many people, it's scary to step forward on an issue like this.
Well, let's establish a little historical perspective, and that is during World War II, people of German descent and people of Japanese descent, American citizens of both German and Japanese descent, ended up in internment camps. So if the Muslims have a fear of the same thing being recreated, the history is on their side.
Indeed. Although, are you sure that Americans of German descent were rounded up? I thought it was just the Japanese.
I believe that in New Jersey, on the East Coast, I believe that some were. I can't say that for certain.
Well, they didn't grab my grandmother anyway.
Oh.
I have a German grandmother who experienced the trauma of both world wars being here in the U.S., and apparently they all spoke German, were very proud of their heritage right up to World War One, and then after the anti-German propaganda onslaught from the mass media, they all sort of crawled back into their shells and were really ashamed of being German from then on.
Mm-hmm.
But I never heard of her having to worry about being interned during World War II. I think they went after the Japanese a lot more intensely out of racism. Japanese people, they look different, they're racially different, they're Eastern. And unfortunately, Muslims are vulnerable to the same kind of thing, because so many Muslims in the U.S. are either African American, which of course has been the despised outgroup forever, or they're immigrants from these countries where people are seen as having, you know, dark skin and, you know, having funny beliefs and, you know, funny habits and so on. So Muslims really do have to be careful, because we are in this kind of group that can get targeted racially, mm-hmm. in the same way the Japanese were.
Mm-hmm. Well, there's I grew up in Southern California, and there were a lot of Japanese Americans in Southern California that were very successful farmers. And one of the reasons for rounding them up, supposedly, this is what I heard, was that they had a lot of good agricultural land that other farmers were covetous of. And so rounding them up and putting them in camps was a nice way to confiscate their valuable farmland. Maybe the Germans on the East Coast didn't have anything that we wanted.
Right. You know, unfortunately, that's a really kind of dark side of human nature, that this kind of greed comes out in these crisis situations, in genocide situations such as in Rwanda and probably in Nazi Germany as well. When Jews were rounded up in Nazi Germany, of course, the fact that Jews were relatively well off and had property was one motivation for doing that. And I'm sure that kind of thing has happened many times in many places. And let's just try to make sure it doesn't ever happen here.
Right.
Again.
Let's jump into something controversial. You have been quoted as being a denier of the Holocaust. Would you like to explain that?
Well, you heard what I just said. Do I sound like a Holocaust denier? What happened? It's very strange. There's this very unpleasant fellow. I don't know if I should name him. It's not going to get your station in trouble if I tell you his name, will it?
I don't think so, but unless it's really pertinent to your views on the Holocaust.
All right. His first name is Mark.
Okay.
He runs a website in Oregon, and he started stalking me after I organized the David Ray Griffin event at the University of Wisconsin-Madison, stalking me, harassing me, ranting about the Holocaust, ranting about anti-Semitism, and I wasn't even interested in these topics, and he just kept emailing me over and over and over and this and that and the other. And then the next thing you know, he's invented some story that I have endorsed the views of three prominent Holocaust deniers, two of whom I had never even heard of at the time, and the third of which I knew almost nothing about. So this libel from this guy, which he posted on the internet, aha, you know, Kevin Barrett endorses these three prominent Holocaust deniers, it ended up on my Wikipedia page, and it's dogged me ever since. And finally, this past year, I said, "This, you know, I've denied this over and over." I said, "Look, I don't even know anything about this issue, and I don't even know, you know, at the time that he said this, I didn't even know who two of these people were."
What is your position on the Holocaust?
Well, I was getting to that. This year, okay. I finally decided to try to look into it.
Okay.
Because, you know, if they're slandering me as a Holocaust denier, and I don't even know anything about the topic,
at least understand the slander.
Yeah, so I can defend myself. Yeah. What exactly am I being accused of? So I read a book by the editor of Skeptic magazine, Michael Shermer, who's also he's an anti 9/11 truth guy, and he has a book, I forget the title, it's about why do they deny the Holocaust. It sort of psychoanalyzes this leading list of so-called Holocaust deniers. So I read that, and he also, in that book, he tries to show why each of these people's ideas about the Holocaust are wrong. And then I read a second book called, just recently, called Debating the Holocaust, A New Look at Both Sides by Thomas Dalton. And Dalton argues that, in fact, some of the Holocaust revisionists are probably correct, or at least have a lot of evidence on their side for their claims that, according to him, there's very little evidence of anywhere near, millions of deaths in gas chambers. There's not even much evidence for any gas chambers at all. He argues that the number of victims was probably close to 500,000, which is still a lot. And what else? That it was not an intentional, thought-out genocidal plan, but it was kind of an ad hoc thing that happened as the war led to such extreme poverty that people couldn't be fed anymore. So after reading both of those, I have to say that I don't yet know whether I, or to what extent I agree with either the official narrative that there were 6 million Jews, most of them killed in gas chambers, or this alternative narrative, which I've known for years is widely believed by scholars who've looked into it in the Arab and Muslim world. Virtually every fellow professor I met in Morocco strongly doubted the 6 million killed in gas chambers story. So I'm actually, I've gotten interested. Before this, before I was slandered as a Holocaust denier, I just assumed that the standard version was true.
Okay.
But at this point, I'm still convinced that a great many Jews and others were murdered by the Nazis. Whether that number is 500,000 or 6 million, whether whatever the number is, I don't have any way
to
know.
The point that I was leading to, and I did a poor job of doing it, was in some of your writings, you said something I found very interesting, and that was, given that there was a Holocaust in Germany and in Europe against the Jews, given that that's true no matter what the numbers are and no matter what the circumstances are, the point you made was that there have been many Holocausts in recent history. The Armenian Holocaust by the Turks, the Rwandan Holocaust. There's been many examples of genocide, and you were questioning why the world is focusing on this particular Holocaust, and perhaps it's being exploited for political reasons. Would you like to go into that?
Well, thanks, Shaba. And that's the important point. The details about the Nazi Holocaust against the Jews are really not that important. We know that the Nazis brutally persecuted the Jews and that large numbers of Jews were killed, along with the other 60 million people killed in World War II. So that's really not much of a subject for debate. But as far as the significance of the various Holocausts in history, that's really what's important. And I think Arabs and Muslims have a very different view of the way the Nazi Holocaust has been used than Americans of other stripes do. It's so clear to us that this excuse for establishing a Jewish state in Palestine was that the Jews have been so horribly oppressed and persecuted by the Nazis that they need a national homeland. But wait a minute, why Palestine? The Palestinians didn't perpetrate the Holocaust. So if there's going to be a Jewish state as restitution for the Holocaust, obviously it has to be in Germany, not in Palestine. Given this brainwashing that we're subjected to, that Israel is legitimate because of the Holocaust, we have to sit down and say, well, why? How can they be purveying such an obvious lie that the Holocaust justifies Israel? The Holocaust does not justify Israel. It cannot. It cannot justify the theft of even one square inch of Palestinian land. And yet we're endlessly bombarded with this propaganda that because of the Holocaust, the poor oppressed Jews deserve to ethnic cleanse the Palestinians and perpetrate a Holocaust against the Palestinians. And this doesn't make any sense. I mean, we have to be against all Holocausts.
Okay, so basically what you're saying is that it's a shame-based argument.
Well, it's not just a shame-based argument, but it's just completely illogical.
Okay.
It has no logic. Why Palestine?
Okay. So let me interrupt at this point to thank Lita Barlow. Thank you very much for your contribution, and remind listeners that this is a pledge drive. If this show interests you, either now or previous shows that I've done, this is your chance to say thank you by supporting this show and supporting KVMR. If you find that our conversation is so interesting that you don't want to interrupt a phone in now, that's understandable. It's a compliment. But please, when you do phone in your pledge, please mention Rabble Rousing. And you phone in your pledge by phoning 265-9555 or 1-800-355-5867. Again, I'm kind of skirting around the 9/11 issue before we dive into it. Some Muslims claim that Islamic economics could solve many of the world's problems. Please explain Islamic economics to us, and do you agree with that statement?
Islamic economics is a kind of a real broad term that certain Muslims use to describe both these general principles that should guide our economic transactions and behavior, and then also some more specific rules. And it's a really interesting subject. Unfortunately, a lot of it is not very clearly laid out. It's a tough subject to really wrap your mind around. But I'll do my best to give you my sense of what these core principles are and what the rules are. And of course, the first rule of Islamic economics would be no lending at interest, period. That's called riba, or usury. And it's okay to invest. In Islamic economics or Islamic law, you can invest money and get a profit if your investment does well, or take a loss if it does badly, but you are not allowed to invest your money and be guaranteed X percent rate of return. That is usury. As far as the general principles of Islamic economics, it starts with the good of all ordinary people being the number one priority. So It's not like, I think our capitalist system, our free market system is geared towards people having the freedom to try to get a lot richer than everybody else. And this is not a value in Islamic thought at all. Quite the opposite. There's a wonderful surah from the Quran called Surah At-Takathur, or the piling up, the heaping up, that just really excoriates this tendency of people to want to pile up their possessions and get richer than other people. And it points out that people who do that are destroying their own souls. So the first priority is the welfare of everybody, and charity, or those who have extra money, instead of investing it in interest so they can get even richer, they should be giving it away. That's the top priority. There's a kind of institutionalized charity that takes the place of taxation. It's called zakat. As far as the markets go, Islamic economics asks for an absolutely free market of small businessmen. Corporations are not part of the tradition. Corporations, of course, are these fictitious entities that allow individuals to evade responsibility for their actions. The corporation takes a big loss, and the individual shareholders are not liable for that. In fact, the definition of a corporation is an entity, a fictitious entity created to help people avoid responsibility for their own decisions. Mm-hmm. So Islam doesn't have this. The whole corporate idea comes out of Christianity. You know, Christianity has a religious bureaucracy, and the corporation is organized like that bureaucracy. Islam has no religious bureaucracy. It's each individual facing God. So the Islamic free market is individual small proprietors out in the free marketplace, working not against each other, but working with each other to provide material to the people at a fair profit.
Let me interrupt here, because American bankers would probably make the same claims, that they're working for the good of the total welfare. But as I understand American banking, it's based primarily on getting interest on loans. If Islamic banking does not get interest on loans, how do they survive?
It's a different different approach to human nature, and the belief is that people will give away their extra money rather than invest it at interest. And throughout history, they did. You get huge points with God, you know, a ticket to paradise to the extent that you give away what you have. This is the gift economy concept. Northwest Indians had the potlatch, where whoever gives away the most gets the most prestige. And
okay,
that's found in all kinds of traditional economies, and I think that the Islamic economy is a kind of a very nice balanced combination of the free market economy and the gift economy, the potlatch economy. And we've completely forgotten the gift and potlatch economies. It only operates within nuclear families at Christmas time now in this culture.
Okay, so Kevin, allow me to challenge you at this point. You and I are going to form a bank, and we're going to form an Islamic bank. So we construct some brick building on the corner, and now we're in business. How are we going to make enough money to keep going to, you know, so you and I can send our kids to college, so we can pay our employees, so we can pay off the mortgage on this brick structure we built on the corner? How are we going to do that if we're not collecting interest on our loans? Can't
well,
come out of generosity. We'll go broke.
You know, Shabba, you're right about that. So the bank as the kind of institution that we know now maybe doesn't even have a place in Islamic economics. I know a lot of Muslim economists would probably disagree with me. There are Islamic banks out there, and what they do is they charge a fee. They disguise their interest as something else. They'll charge a fee for making a loan or, you know, something other than a percentage of the money. But there's a critique of that that says that that's not really that different from charging interest. And so often they actually set these fees to end up being pretty equivalent to the going interest rate. So how is that different from just charging interest? I think that a real Islamic economy would not be based on those kinds of banks. It's based on a different view of human nature, and you have to get that human nature to get this kind of economy. You have to get people back into the mindset where they will be respected by their neighbors and their fellow people based on how much they give to those in need. And giving to somebody who has a business prospect is also laudable. Secondly, though, I think speaking more practically about how could we reform the system that we have now to make it work, I would argue that banking should be a public trust. It should not be a private individual profit motive kind of activity, just like medicine. You know, I was the only libertarian candidate for Congress in history probably to call for single-payer health care.
Oh, really? Uh-huh.
Yeah, I ran in 2008 here in Wisconsin as a libertarian and got over 8,000 votes despite my crazy ideas. And one of my crazy ideas is I'm a libertarian for single-payer health care. I think we'll all have more freedom if we have a single-payer system. I think that health is not a place for the profit motive. It's a place for service to humanity, and the same is true of money. And so what I would like to see happen in the short run in the U.S. is we need to have our government prosecute the criminals who are in charge of the pyramid scam known as our financial system and our Federal Reserve. They should all be jailed. Their ill-gotten assets should be seized and returned to the people, and the government should institute a banking system in which money would be created not by loans at interest by private parties with no backing to the money thus created, but rather it should be created in a balanced fashion, with maybe a third of the money should be directly funding public works projects. That is, rebuild passenger rail service, pay the people to rebuild it, and that's how you put money in circulation. And some of it should be through perhaps interest-free loans with fees attached based on people's ability to pay, voluntary contributions asked for, and so on. So I think a real Islamic system in the modern age would look like something like that, a transparent money system that would be government-run and administered, but would have to be completely transparent to make it different, really different from what we have now.
Okay. I think we've covered that, and thank you. We want to thank Sam from Cedar Ridge for a donation, and we want to encourage other listeners to support KVMR. Now's your chance to do so. If this show is too interesting that you don't want to interrupt, we understand, but when you do phone in your pledge, please mention Rabble Rousing. The numbers to phone in your pledge, 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867. I've been skirting around the issue of 9/11, which you're very involved in. Before we get into that, is there any aspect of what Muslims believe, and especially out in the Muslim world, that Americans might be surprised to know about?
Well, many Americans are surprised to learn that 4 out of 5 Muslims around the world thinks it was an inside job, or at least they don't think that it was done by Arab hijackers. And that based on data from the world's biggest polling outfits, including Pew Public Opinion Services and worldpublicopinion.com. And 60% of American Muslims feel the same way. We don't hear much about that. We occasionally hear in the mainstream media references to Muslims having more conspiracy theorists per capita than other groups, but that's about it. And I think it's really important because, you know, we're told that this was the act of radical Muslims, and yet if most Muslims don't believe that, then that really changes the picture, right? I mean, ordinary Americans think that it's these nasty Muslim radicals against American civilization, but if almost all the world's Muslims don't think that it was actually, you know, the U.S. government and or Israel that did 9/11, then we have a very strange kind of clash of civilizations going. It means that they obviously don't support al-Qaeda, since they think that this great act of al-Qaeda was actually the act of the enemy of Muslims.
Okay. Let's establish a couple of terms here, and that is conspiracy theory. Let us keep firmly in mind that the government story of Arab hijackers with box cutter knives capturing planes and blah, 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 that is a conspiracy theory.
Not only that, it's a wildly improbable conspiracy theory.
Yes, but I mean, as long as we're going to talk about conspiracy theories, we have to keep foremost in our minds that the government story is the original conspiracy theory.
It certainly is, Shamba. The definition of a conspiracy is two or more people operating together to commit some kind of a crime or an unethical act. And certainly, it must have been more than one person that did 9/11. Therefore, all of us are conspiracy theorists because we all admit that it was some sort of conspiracy, whether, you know, 19 Arabs led by a guy on dialysis in a cave in Afghanistan, or
who immediately denied having any involvement in it when he should have taken credit for it.
Right. That's very strange. Why would Bin Laden pop up several times in September and early October 2001? Saying he didn't do it, and in a couple of his interviews he deplored 9/11, said it was killing civilians on that scale was totally un-Islamic and so on. Although he did, there's one interview he did that appears to be authentic with Taysir Alooni of Al Jazeera in late October. This is after the U.S. invasion of Afghanistan, where he's clearly angry because of this invasion, and he kind of says, well, the Americans deserved it. In such a way that, you know, a naive viewer would think that maybe he was taking credit for it. He wasn't. He was just kind of, at that point, cheering it on. He was apparently angry about the U.S. invasion. But then he's almost certainly been dead since December 2001, and people curious about the evidence for that should read David Ray Griffin's book, Osama Bin Laden, Dead or Alive.
Okay. What is the evidence for Israeli involvement in 9/11?
There is a lot of evidence. It could all be called circumstantial one way or another. You know, there's no smoking gun that proves that the Mossad did it. But there are so many indications that it seems clear that the Israeli Mossad must have played some kind of a role in 9/11. For example, there's the evidence of foreknowledge by Israel. Zim, Israeli-American shipping lines, moved out of the World Trade Center less than 1 week before 9/11. Breaking its lease to do so. There's also the case of the Odigo instant messaging services. A Hebrew message was sent out to the users of Odigo, which is an Israeli-based instant messaging service, warning the people to stay away from the World Trade Center on the morning of 9/11. There's also the dancing Israelis, these Mossad spies who were caught on 9/11, filming the towers. They were set up to film the towers before the first plane hit. They filmed the entire event, including the collapse of the towers, and they were celebrating and high-fiving, taking pictures of each other, flicking cigarette lighters in front of the burning and then exploding towers. They were picked up by the police, held for 2 months. They failed lie detector tests. These guys, when they were caught, they had thousands of dollars in cash stuffed in their socks. They worked for a Mossad front known as Van Lines. It was a moving company in New Jersey run by a guy named Dominic Suter, who fled the country instantly and has been on Interpol's list. He's wanted for involvement in 9/11, apparently. In this alt, another tie-in was this huge Israeli spy ring that shadowed the alleged hijackers prior to 9/11. Everywhere these alleged hijackers went, there was a crack Mossad team of surveillance people right next door to them. When this was broken on Fox News by Carl Cameron in December, I believe, 2001, there were all kinds of denials, but it turns out that this whole story was confirmed repeatedly. Another mainstream journalist who confirmed it is Christopher Ketchum, who wrote a great story about this for Salon.com. His high-level intelligence source said that a lot of patriots in U.S. intelligence have been trying to get this information about Israeli connections to 9/11 out, but they're taking great risks because patriots are dead. That's a direct quote from a high-level intelligence guy. Another interesting direct quote was from the FBI source of Carl Cameron on Fox News. That FBI source said that, quote, Israeli connections to 9/11 are classified, quote, unquote. I can't talk to you about it.
Really?
Yeah. That's a direct quote from a Fox News special, a three-part special by Carl Cameron that broadcast in late 2001.
Hmm. Some of the notes I've read, you refer to a book by somebody on pilots for 9/11 truth.
I don't remember referring to a book by anybody in pilots, but I do support the organization Pilots, which has done a wonderful job, and they've shown that the stories of the planes, the plane hitting the Pentagon, the government's flight path given from all of their data, is completely impossible.
Yeah, you can't do that in that plane. The plane is physically, even if you had an expert pilot, rather than some guy that just learned and wasn't trusted to fly a Cessna, even if you had an excellent pilot, the plane was not capable of those maneuvers. Is that what you're speaking of?
Mm-hmm. That's absolutely right. And that speed. All of these planes are clocked at, two out of three, the Pentagon plane and the second plane at the World Trade Center are clocked at over 500 knots. This is for a jetliner of this type to try to go over 500 knots at sea level is a complete joke. Pilots, went to a lot of lengths to investigate to make sure they were right about this,
mm-hmm.
and indeed they concluded that there is absolutely no way that these 767s and 757s could go that fast. They would break apart before they reached that speed at sea level, and indeed their engines couldn't possibly bring them anywhere near that speed at sea level anyway. So all of the data showing that these planes were taking these particular flight paths and going at this speed suggests that whatever we were seeing, whatever was making that data, it certainly was not passenger 757s and 767s.
Okay. From the literature I've read, it seems like the 9/11 truth movement has been infiltrated, and that there's a lot of disinformation, and some of the sites calling themselves 9/11 truth are anything but. Would you like to comment on that?
Sure. I think a lot of people who are worried about disinformation in the 9/11 truth movement are worried mostly about bad information. They think that if we get something wrong or if somebody puts out some information that's incorrect or sounds preposterous, that this will somehow discredit us in the eyes of the general public. So they're worried about people who think that maybe the World Trade Center was destroyed by some kind of an exotic weapon. Or they're worried about people who claim that there were no planes hitting the World Trade Center. It was all done through video fakery, that sort of thing. And I suppose there may be some of that, but I think that if you look at the history of COINTELPRO, what they mainly do is they try to stir up fights in whatever community they're afflicting. For instance, they turned leaders of the Black Panthers against each other. And they don't care what the issues are. They just want to get you fighting. So when I look at the infighting going on in the 9/11 truth movement and try to figure out, who's causing it, it's very tricky to try to figure that out because, people naturally get very attached to their own ideas and they argue with people who have different ideas. But I'm pretty sure that there is some COINTELPRO type stoking of these flames of infighting in the 9/11 truth movement. And I'm sure there are people on both sides, infiltrators or COINTELPRO agents on both sides of some of these disputes, who are trying to keep these fights going. So really the answer, to the way to deal with this within the 9/11 truth movement is to not get too attached to any arguments, to try not to waste too much time on internet fights and flame wars, and rather to try to focus on what we all agree on, which is that the official story is ridiculous and impossible, and we need a new investigation.
Okay. There was recently an attempt in New York City to put a ballot initiative up for voters. Would you describe that and what happened?
Right. That was called the New York City 9/11 Ballot Initiative, and people can read about it at nyccan.org. That's nyccan.org. It was led by a bunch of great people, including, well, Les Jamison started it out. Let's see, William Pepper became the legal attorney, the legal mind behind it. Ted Walter is the latest executive director. And their purpose was to use these laws that allow you to put an initiative directly to the voters to get a real investigation of 9/11. So they drafted a bunch of prospective commissioners who included very honest people and people who have questioned the official version of 9/11, and they went out to get signatures. If they got 30,000 signatures, it was supposed to go on the ballot, assuming the city council okayed it. And then what happened was they got plenty of signatures. The city tried to claim that they didn't have enough signatures. They went through arbitration and proved that they had plenty. Then at the next stage, the city appealed to a higher court, saying that this initiative is illegal because various things in it conflict with various laws and so on. And the initiative actually had written into it the statement that anything in this initiative resolution that conflicts with other laws can be tweaked as long as it leaves the gist of the initiative in place. But the appeals didn't work. So the final appeal was turned down, I think, last week. And they could have appealed it to one more level. They sat down and looked at it and decided that their chances of winning at the next level were so poor that it would be better to husband their resources for a different kind of legal effort. William Pepper told me on my radio show yesterday that they're hoping to file a damages lawsuit. I guess it will be on behalf of plaintiffs affected by 9/11, such as 9/11 family members and first responders, and these people are going to be suing somebody in a carefully selected district, selected so that they'll have the greatest chance of success getting the right kind of judge, and they're hoping that this will provide them with the power to subpoena witnesses. And so that's where the legal effort is moving to now. It's too bad that the ballot initiative failed. My first response was, how can they be not pursuing this even further? But apparently the decision was that they would appeal, and they would almost certainly just lose again, given the government's stonewalling on this issue and the way that the courts are stacked. Apparently, when you're doing lawsuits, you need to find the right court to pursue your case, especially if it's something controversial like this. So they're really shopping around and trying to find the right kind of legal venue where they can actually win.
Can't the government just switch courts?
I don't think so. I think there's some sort of complicated procedure governing where jurisdiction is for different kinds of lawsuits. And so if you file in the right kind of court, you then limit the options of where that can be decided.
I see, because the thing that stands out in my mind most egregious was in the case of the Oklahoma City bombing trials, where they moved it from Oklahoma City, they moved it to Denver, they being the government. They cherry-picked their judge, Richard Mache, and it was a bogus trial. So it appears to me that the government has the power to move these things around much more than citizens have the power to move things around, and the government just finds a compliant judge and it's thrown out of court.
Well, John, but there's some truth to that, but I think that's a little too simple. In the case of the Oklahoma City bombings, that was a criminal prosecution, so the government was initiating the case.
Okay.
So whoever's initiating the case decides what court it's going
to
be in.
Okay.
And so if you're filing a civil lawsuit, you can choose which court to file it in to some extent. For instance, if you have people who lost their loved ones on 9/11 who live in New Jersey, and you have others who live in New York City. You can choose whether to file this suit in New York City or New Jersey.
But you're still stuck with a judge that's there.
Indeed, and that's why you need to know something about the judges. And so once you have a good lawyer like William Pepper is able to get a sort of a cheat sheet on the various judges in the various districts and get a handle on which ones are honest.
Okay.
Try to find an honest judge.
Okay, and he's the one that basically decided, you know what, with a judge in place, there's no way we're going to win this appeal. Let's not waste our energy.
Exactly. They could see where this appeal would go.
Uh-huh.
They looked at who it was going to go to.
Right.
And they said, no, it's not worth it.
Gotcha. What a game.
Yeah. Yeah, it's really astounding, the level of corruption in this society. You know, people abroad often think that the U.S. is a very honest society, very free from corruption. In Morocco, I know, which has got a lot of really obvious corruption. You know, you get pulled over by the cops, and, you know, you just hand them a few bucks, and that's good enough. So they think that the U.S. is a very honest society. My wife still kind of has this impression that it's, the U.S. is generally honest. I think that's true at a certain level of society. The middle class is pretty honest overall. But at higher levels, in the judiciary, in the political system, in the military, the higher you go, the more corrupt it seems to get. And I suppose, you know, I actually have a theory about why that is.
Well, to me, it's just efficiency. If you're going to corrupt a system, why should you bother at the basic level? Corrupt it at the top and you've won the game.
That's probably part of it. You know, my theory is a little more elaborate. I wrote an internet essay that got hundreds of thousands of Google hits. It got spread all over the place. It's called Twilight of the Psychopaths. And in that essay, I argue that there's a tendency for psychopaths to rise to the top of power hierarchies because they have advantages over the rest of us. Psychopaths are people, they're hardwired to lie and to kill. They can kill without feeling any qualms. They can lie without feeling any qualms. So people like that are in a position to really do well in, say, military hierarchies, which are about killing, or intelligence hierarchies, or political hierarchies, which are about lying.
You wouldn't be describing our ex-vice president, would you?
He's a classic case, isn't he?
Yeah, he's a beauty. He really is a beauty.
The president isn't much either, but I think the vice president really takes the cake for obvious, clear, you know, walking examples of psychopathy on live television. And, you know, did you see, Shama, that in December he did that interview, I forget who it was with, he was asked, what was the highest moment of the past 8 years as vice president? And he said, highest moment of the last 8 years. Well, you know, that would have to be 9/11 itself.
Right.
He's shameless.
Yeah, well, it was his coup d'etat.
I guess. Must have been a high moment.
Yes. Let's see. Where do we go from here? Well, one place we go from here is we remind our listeners that if you're enjoying this show and shows like it, you have a responsibility at this point. Your responsibility is to pay us back for all the efforts we put out. And this is your opportunity. You know that shows like this are very rare on the radio dial. They're even rarer in newsprint. KVMR is a special station. We provide 24/7 for your pleasure and for your entertainment and for your education. And this show, I hope you will feel as one of those examples. This is your chance to give us a donation of any size to KVMR. Give us a phone call, 265-9555 or 1-877-355-5867. Phone in your pledge of any amount and ask the phone answerers what the range of gifts are. I can tell you briefly that our guest Kevin Barrett has written two books, which he's generously contributed. One is Questioning the War on Terror. The other is Truth Jihad. These you will find helpful if you want to convince other people of the truth of 9/11. Then there's Naturai Karta, which is a DVD, Jews Against Zionism. And Kevin, I think you should describe that DVD for us.
Sure. Yeah, let me even get into the sort of a larger topic of Zionism. You know, how could you be against Zionism? We're constantly bombarded with this idea that only, you know, evil radicals and anti-Semites and Nazis and people like that are against Israel. And even questioning Israel or saying they should go back to the 67 borders often sets off this kind of this chorus of denunciations and attacks, anybody with the kind of guts to say that, like Jimmy Carter, of course. So, you know, people like me who go one step further and say, why should there be a Jewish state in Palestine at all? The whole thing is completely illegitimate, are really sticking our necks out. And yet, if this is the opinion of probably just about, 1,499,999 of the world's 1.5 billion Muslims. Did I get that right? Anyway, it's the standard Muslim view that Israel is an illegitimate entity, that there was never any just authority to ethnic cleanse the native people of Palestine and move them out and make way for an apartheid Jewish state in which Jewish people are defined as first-class citizens and everybody else, especially the natives, are second-class citizens.
Okay. I think it's important at this point to differentiate between Jews, Israelis, and Zionists.
Absolutely. Jews are people, well, there's a little fudging that goes on here. Normally, we would say that, you know, Muslims are adherents of the Islamic religion, Christians are adherents of the religion of Christ, and Jews are adherents of the religion of Judaism. And by that standard, Jews are just, you know, another religion.
It's just a religion, right.
Right, it's just a religion. And it's a really quite fascinating religion. The base text, the Torah, is one of the great literary monuments of humanity, regardless of whether you think it makes a good scripture or not. In my case, I'm not so sure about that. But I'll have to admit that it is a literary masterpiece, and I can understand how this group of people have honored this text down through the years. And there's a great Jewish ethical tradition as well that grows out of the religion. So that's something that has to be kept separate from Zionism and from Israel. Zionism is this movement to build a so-called Jewish state in Palestine. And, of course, Israel is the name of this officially Jewish state that Zionists created. And people like me and people like Naturai Karta, who are Orthodox Jews, argue that there never should have been a Jewish state in Palestine, and that, in fact, much of the world's Jewish community has really lost its way morally and ethically by stopping, they no longer worship God as much as they worship the state of Israel. And the state is based on the systematic expulsion and ethnic cleansing of the people of Palestine, and then the maintaining those people in a state of second-class citizenship. And all of this is extremely unjust, and it violates all ethical principles, including the ethical principles of Judaism itself.
Kevin, practically speaking, what can you do? What would you do? What would you propose? The state of Israel exists. What's the solution at this point? You're not going to get them to leave.
Oh, no. If there's a terrible enough war, they might leave. Certainly, they haven't had, you know, the Israeli have not tended to stick around when times get tough. I've been told by people who live there that Tel Aviv was a ghost town during the Gulf War of 1990 when Scud missiles were coming in, even though they were very unlikely to hit anybody. Millions of Israelis left to their havens in Europe and the U.S. And my friends who are Israelis, some of them Jewish and some of them Palestinian, but of Israeli citizenship, tell me that Jewish Israelis know deep down inside that it's not their country, that they've taken over unjustly from somebody else. So, no, I think that they might leave. And if you look at Algeria, another European colonial state, Algeria was officially a part of France. It was just as much France as Paris is. That was the belief of all French people, and especially the settler colonialists in Algeria. And yet they left. Why? Well, because when Europeans try to establish a European settler colony in non-European territory, two things can happen. One, they can perpetrate genocide and kill off virtually all of the native peoples, and that's what happened here in North America, right. Happened in Australia, happened in parts of temperate zone South America, happened in New Zealand, and that was mostly due to things like disease and to this incursion of European organisms, it ended up genociding the people who lived here. So that's one possible.
Basically, we beat the crap out of them. We stole their land. That's it.
Right, and most importantly, we killed them off. So
yeah.
Now there's less than 1% of people in North America are Native American. There's no question of any kind of resistance, really, by Native Americans anymore. They can resist and try and have their own little fiefdoms, but they can't possibly get back North America. It's not going to happen. Whereas in places like Algeria, South Africa, Kenya, now Zimbabwe, which used to be Rhodesia, in all of these European settler colonies, you had a minority of Europeans who went and colonized an area with a majority of indigenous people. And this small minority of Europeans, surrounded by this big majority of indigenous people, was in a very untenable situation. They couldn't possibly kill off all of the indigenous people of southern Africa or of eastern Africa or of North Africa, which is where Algeria was. And today, the European settler colonialists in Palestine, with their state of Israel, cannot possibly kill off all of the Middle Easterners. So what that means is that there's only one possible outcome, and that is decolonization. It can happen through war and terror, which is what happened in Algeria, where the Europeans did have to flee Algeria. The Pied Noir had to leave because they couldn't compromise and give Algeria back to the majority peacefully. But in South Africa, the settler colonialists from Europe, surrounded by this African majority, said, okay, here's what we're going to do. We're going to change this from an apartheid Afrikaner state to a state for all its people peacefully. And that's what they did. South Africa now has an equal protection clause. All people are officially equal in the Constitution of South Africa. And that's exactly what we have to have in Israel and Palestine. We need a one state with an equal protection clause where all citizens are equal, regardless of whether they're Jews or Arabs, Christians, Muslims, Jews, whatever.
Do you think that's practically achievable given the level of bloodshed between the two?
I think it's not only practically achievable, I think it's inevitable. In fact, it's the level of bloodshed that makes it inevitable, because in South Africa, the reason that the whites finally decided to hand over power to a democratic regime with an equal protection clause, which they didn't want to do, was because they were facing a potential bloodbath. They were surrounded by a huge black population, including in their own country, and they really had no choice. And likewise, we're in exactly the same situation with Israel-Palestine. The Israelis are trying to maintain their apartheid Jewish-only state with nukes and atrocious violence. And the more violence they use and the more nukes they build, the more they undermine their own credibility and their own legitimacy in the eyes of the world. So they're in exactly the same situation the South African Afrikaners were in a little bit before 1990, and the only possible outcome is for them to do what the Afrikaners did and create a state for all its people.
Okay. Let's interrupt to thank Sandy Sakamono for a generous contribution. And thank you, Sandy. She's from Cedar Ridge. And remind other listeners that if you're listening to this show, it must interest you. Now's your time to send in a contribution. Join KVMR. By the way, if you join as a new member, we have a special thing called the 3030 Club. And that means this is for new members only. A $60 membership with all of the gifts and all of the privileges will only cost you $30, because a KVMR board member has generously agreed to pick up the difference. So if you want to become a new member, a $60 membership will only cost you $30. And for other members, when you phone in, you can ask what the premiums and gifts are. But it's important that you show your support this radio station. And you might even want to support shows such as this. The numbers are 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867. You're listening to Rabble Rousing. Your host is Chamba Lane. Our guest is Kevin Barrett. We've got another half hour to go. Where should we go from here, Kevin?
Well, if it were me, I'd probably just open the phone lines, but I guess you're only opening the phone lines to...
Unfortunately, we're not set up. I would love to open the phone lines, and I'm sure my listeners are chafing at the bit. But the way we have it set up for the Pledge Drive, I have no other phone lines. So, unfortunately, we might do a repeat of this some other time when we can. Okay, you're saying 9/11 was basically a Mossad-assisted coup d'etat by hardline Zionists.
Probably. I hedge my bets on that a little bit, because there is, you know, there's plenty of evidence that high-level American people were involved. Cheney has got 9/11 guilt written all over his face.
Absolutely.
And, of course, we have the Secret Service in Florida, which did not whisk Bush away to safety when told that the country was under attack. Bush just kept on reading about my pet goat with school children. And it was 9:04 when he was told that a second plane had hit, meaning the country was under attack. And he stayed in that room for about 10 minutes reading My Pet Goat. He didn't get out of the room until almost 9:30. And then he took a slow route to the airport where Air Force One was and took off at almost 10 o'clock. So almost an hour went by with no normal protective reaction from the Secret Service. That means somebody at the top of the Secret Service must have known that the president was not a target, meaning that they were in on it. So I could go on like this, but I'm sure you get the idea that there's so much evidence against certain people in the Secret Service, the military, the FBI, and, of course, the vice president's office, that we can't just say that this was pure and simple some kind of Mossad operation. But what we can say is that, number one, 9/11 served Israeli or hardline Israeli geostrategic interests, and it did not really serve American geostrategic interests. We didn't need, the American national interest, which of course is kind of a dubious proposition, but we did not need to launch this war of civilizations against Islam. We did not need to invade Iraq to get its energy resources. They would just sell it to us. Saddam was willing to deal with us. It was 9/11, looking at it from the perpetrator's perspective, was a huge, huge risk. And the U.S. was in a position where it didn't need to take that kind of risk. The U.S. we're in a very powerful position. We still have a pretty strong industrial base, even though we shipped a lot of it to China. And we have, you know, we have long coastlines on both oceans, the world's biggest military. We were not in a position where we needed to risk something like 9/11.
I'm going to dispute you on that in a bit, but maybe rather than interrupting you now, I want you to establish your point.
Right. Yeah, the Israelis, on the other hand, do have a good reason to need to take huge risks. As I was saying, Israel is facing the end of its existence as a Jewish state for very simple and obvious, you know, historical and demographic reasons. And those in Israel who are absolutely committed to maintaining Israel into the indefinite future as a Jewish state need to take huge risks. And in this case, they would have needed to find a way to ensure that the world's biggest military power, the United States of America, would be engaged in civilizational warfare against the world's 1.5 billion Muslims for the indefinite future. That was the only possible way that Israel was even going to last as a Jewish state for more than another couple of decades. So there's a very strong geostrategic motive for Israel, and I think that the way I would see this is that those who are very, very concerned about the future of Israel, and it's not just Jews, there are Christian Zionists and there are probably atheist Zionists as well out there. In fact, most of the Jewish Zionists, or many of the neocons at least, are atheists. But these people who are really concerned with Israel, I think, are the ones who had the incentive to get the 9/11 inside job ball rolling. And once they did that, they could have corrupted others, corrupted people in the military, corrupted people in the FBI, mobilized agents of, for instance, the banking empires who have already infiltrated parts of the U.S. government, and so on. So there are all sorts of people who are involved in this. But in terms of the motive, I see Israel as having the overriding geostrategic motive for 9/11 and the War of Civilizations that sparked.
Okay, so it sounds like your point is, if the Israelis can get the world attacking the Muslims, that serves Israel.
Well, of course, because as I said, Israel is it's a very small country. It's got somewhere close to 10 million people, and it's in a whole sea of hostile Muslims who will never accept its existence as a Jewish state, and they're certainly not going to accept its rule over Jerusalem, which has been one of the three Islamic holy cities for nearly 1.5 millennia.
Let me challenge you on that. Haven't the Jordanian government, at least, and the Egyptian government have signed peace treaties with Israel? Doesn't
Indeed.
That mean they're accepting Israel as a state?
Well, sure. You can find a couple of puppet stooges to sign agreements to anything, but the majority of the people of Egypt and Jordan will never accept that. Sadat, who signed that peace treaty with Israel, was of course quickly gunned down. And even though these thugs who rule Jordan and Egypt now are surrounded by equally thuggish teams of bodyguards protecting them from their own people, if there were an honest election in either Jordan or Egypt, the Muslim Brotherhood would sweep to power in these countries, especially Egypt, or some other even more anti-Zionist group would. The people of Egypt and Jordan are the ones, and the rest of the Middle East, are the ones who will never accept Israeli rule over Jerusalem, and in the long run will not accept the Jewish state in Palestine.
Okay. Point taken.
Right, and that leads to the problem of these corrupt, thuggish regimes ruling in this region are propped up by the USA. You know, the only democracy in the Middle East is the Islamic Republic of Iran, and they are an honest democracy, and their recent elections were honest elections, unlike many of ours. So it's really ironic that we're calling for democracies in the Middle East, and yet the only democracy in the Middle East is our big enemy, and all of our puppet regimes in the Middle East are the most undemocratic, thuggish regimes on earth.
I'll have to challenge you on Iran, because at least if the news that I read is accurate, the Iranian government is jailing its own dissidents and the people that are saying it wasn't an honest election.
Well, I didn't say that the Iranian government doesn't commit human rights violations. I'm not saying that they don't jail some of their opponents and persecute their opponents. I'm not saying that the Iranian secret services don't go around doing political murders, just like our own secret services do. But it's still a democracy, meaning that, in fact, it's a much more meaningful democracy than we have, because people of different political opinions in Iran have the right to vote for candidates of their choice representing a much wider variety of thought than candidates here in the U.S. And these votes affect national policy.
Okay. They're
meaningful in a way that votes in the U.S. don't. So I would argue that actually Iran is probably significantly more democratic than the U.S., but the U.S. government persecutes its opponents, people like me, probably a little bit less than the Iranian government does.
Okay, I'll give you that. Let me interrupt to thank Margot McBride as a renewing member. Thank you, Margot. She's from Citrus Heights. And remind listeners, we've got 20 minutes left. Please, in the next 20 minutes, phone in your pledges to KVMR to keep shows like this going, because KVMR is going to continue going. We ain't going anywhere. We're financially sound. We need money to operate, but we're not pleading poverty. We are financially sound. We eventually want to get our own facility. We are growing and improving. So the radio station's not going away, but the program committee chooses which programs are broadcast on KVMR. And there's always a question, is rabble-rousing worth continuing? And this is where you can show your support for this particular show and the spoken word show is similar to it. So this is your chance to tell KVMR in a very real dollar and cents way that you care about rabble-rousing. Phone in your pledges. 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867. If you choose to phone in a pledge at another time for various reasons, if you care, please mention rabble rousing. Okay, we got 20 minutes left, Kevin.
Well, you know, I wanted to tell you, Shamba, that I really appreciate the way that you don't just yammer on saying, you know, boring things to force people to call in to pledge so that you'll say something interesting or, you know, play some good music or whatever, like some of these stations do. You know, and one of the most interesting pledge drives I ever heard about was when I was living up in Garberville, California. KMUD, K-M-U-D, the station up there, probably a little bit like your station, had this pledge drive where they played nothing but Frank Zappa. And they kept, you know, they would interrupt periodically and say, okay, we'll stop playing Frank Zappa when we reach X amount of our pledge drive. and at first I said, well, heck, I'm not going to send in any money because I like Frank Zappa. So I listened and listened and listened. And, you know, after about, you know, 48 hours of nothing but Frank Zappa, you know, you're about ready to send in your pledge.
No, I choose to keep the pitching to a minimum. That's a dispute around here, but that's my choice. I figure if you're listening to Rabble Rousing, you want information. And whatever we present is what we present. You make up your own minds.
Well, in that case, I won't turn on Frank Zappa and hold my telephone receiver up to the stereo.
Thank you very much. Okay, guys, it's time to phone in your pledges. 265-9555, 1-800-355-5867. And when you phone in your pledge, you can ask the lovely people answering the phone what the choice of and range of gifts are. Okay, we've got about 15, 20 minutes left. And what do you think we haven't covered that you'd like to cover?
Well, I guess I'm obliged to, you know, bring another message from our sponsors and say that my book, Questioning the War on Terror, A Primer for Obama Voters, is a perfect book to throw at your Obama voting friends who don't quite understand the depth of depravity to which this nation has sunk since Bush and Cheney's 9/11 inside job. If you want to help bring these Obama voters on board, this book is perfect. And if you contribute during this pledge drive, you can get a copy of my book, Questioning the War on Terror. And inside that book, by the copyright page, you'll find a special offer that you can take that special offer and send in $50 to get 10 more books to give away. So once you've bought one, you're allowed to get 10 more at this incredible price, where you can use them as self-defense weapons to throw at Obama voters that are driving you crazy by just not getting it. You know, people who haven't woken up to the fact that Obama is escalating the war in Afghanistan and launching a new war against Pakistan, which is another illegal war of aggression. And aggression, of course, is the crime for which the Nazis were hanged at Nuremberg. It's the supreme war crime. And yet we're launching yet another of these against Pakistan. And so many Obama voters have the right ideas, and they have they have good hearts, and they have high hopes, but we're not going to end these wars, and we're not going to expose the truth about 9/11 until these people are awakened. And this book is the perfect tool for awakening your sleeping Obama voter friends. It's guaranteed. If you should get 10 of these books and give them to your friends, and none of your friends wake up,
you need new friends.
There you go. I was going to say you get your money back, but no, I think you get your friends back.
Okay, now keep in mind that the book that he's suggesting, that is one of the books that we're offering as a gift for a $60 donation.
That's right. And once you do that, you'll be in a position to get a whole bunch more for this insane price to give to your friends. And so you read it yourself, see what you think, and if you agree that it's the perfect tool for awakening left-leaning people who are still at least half asleep, then you're in a position to actually get out there and spread some truth and help improve humanity's very dire existential situation.
Okay. I'm interested in how we could change the situation in Israel-Palestine. What do you see the steps for moving? Now, you're a proponent of a one nation, of one state.
Right. See, we don't need any more ethnic cleansing, Shamba. There's already been too much ethnic cleansing in the world. And right now there are Jewish Israelis living on all sorts of Palestinian land. These settlements are dotting the landscape in what would be Palestine if there was a two-state solution. And likewise, 20% of the population of Israel is made up of ethnic Palestinian Arabs. Some are Christians, some are Muslims. So the populations are all mixed up in this territory. And it doesn't make sense to draw a line in the sand and say, okay, pick up and move.
Okay, Kevin, how, practically speaking, what practical steps, let's say we made you the emperor, what practical steps to bring peace to the state of Palestine, Israel? You've already stolen, the Palestinians' lands have been stolen. New Israeli settlers have occupied those lands. They've built expensive and inexpensive homes on them. How are you going to get out of this mess?
I think the USA is the only nation right now that has enough leverage with the Israeli government to say, okay, guys, this is it. We are, as of now, going to enforce the UN resolutions on this matter. And the UN resolutions say that Israel must accept back the ethnic cleansing victims and their descendants who were murderously chased out of Israel in 1948, and Israel must return to its 1967 borders. Now, if the U.S. government says we're going to throw the full weight of our diplomatic power and military power behind this, behind these UN resolutions, Israel will have to sue for peace. And at that point, see, as I was saying, it wouldn't really, this two-state solution won't really work, right? Because the settlements are so, you know, there's so many settlements, such a Jewish population in what should be Palestine, and such an Arab-Muslim population in what should be Israel, that at that point, once the U.S. gets on board with the international consensus, then the Israeli government will be in a position, I think, to see that its best interest would be served by a one-state solution, and probably the way to get that would be through some kind of a plebiscite or a vote in which all people who have the right to be citizens of Israel-Palestine, and that would be, of course, everybody who lives there, as well as the Palestinian ethnic cleansing victims and their descendants, wherever they may live, and certainly it doesn't include every Jew in the world.
Well, okay.
Jew in China doesn't have the right to live in Palestine.
Let me take an opposite point of view there. All right.
Okay.
I have no problem with your idea of granting full citizenship to Arabs and Palestinians. But in a practical matter, I have two problems. One, going back to the 67 borders means that you're going back to an Israel that's 7 miles wide at its narrowest point. That's impractical. More important, the Arab lands have already been confiscated. The olive trees, the thousand-year-old olive trees, have been chopped down. Settlements have been built. How are you going to return that land? And what are you going to do with the settlers that are there? And rightfully or wrongfully, they've got an investment there.
Well, Shamba, you've made my point perfectly. That is why when the U.S. gets on board behind these U.N. resolutions, which really we would not want to see enforced, because as you said, that would require moving so many settlers out of their homes. So once the U.S. gets behind the U.N. position on Israel-Palestine, at that point we'll be in a position to say, look, wouldn't it be a better idea to have one state in all of historic Israel-Palestine for all of its citizens? And, of course, some people won't like that, but here's how we'll make it legitimate. We'll have this election, and everybody who lives there now, as well as ethnic cleansing victims and their descendants, gets to vote in the election, and we'll get to vote whether they want a one-state solution, a two-state solution, or whatever. And if that election were held today, I can guarantee you that the one-state solution would win overwhelmingly because, of course, all of the Palestinians and their ethnic cleansing victims all over the world would have the right to vote in that election.
Okay, I agree with you totally, but you still haven't solved the basic dilemma of land.
Oh, sure we have, because now we've got one state, everybody's an equal citizen, all Palestinians who've been ethnic cleansed get to come back.
Come back to what? There's a Jewish settler who's built a house on their land. What are they coming back to?
Well, that's actually a popular misconception that there's no room. Actually, many of these villages that were emptied of their inhabitants by Israelis, or rather Zionists, who came in and bayoneted whole families, bayoneted babies and women, and terrorized them to leave. These places are still vacant. They're still empty. And there's a guy here at the University of Wisconsin-Madison. His name is Nasser Abu-Rafa. He's a Palestinian guy who has come up with a binational solution, where he says, yeah, have one state, but have sort of two nations within the state, one with an official language of Hebrew, one with an official language of Arabic. As part of his national solution, he has shown that there are all sorts of places where Palestinian refugees could come into what's now Israel to settle.
Oh, okay. And then I would propose a further solution, and that is, let me see if you think that the returning Palestinians will go for it. There's plenty of desert land that can be turned into fertile land simply by irrigation. And the Israelis are the state-of-the-art world's leaders in turning desert into fertile land. Do you think that returning Palestinians, rather than wanting their ancestral land, which has now got a three-story building on it, would they settle for good farmland that was created out of desert?
Well, sure, yeah. I don't think anybody would ever expect these guys to come back to Israel and throw the people living in these places out of their homes. Again,
okay.
the whole purpose of this is to avoid any more ethnic cleansing. We've already had enough ethnic cleansing. So
okay.
I would expect that Palestinian ethnic cleansing victims returning to their lands would, you know, rather than always getting the exact same parcel of land that their ancestors had. If that land was occupied, they would presumably get some form of compensation.
Okay.
In the long run, paying this kind of compensation will be cheaper than the military cost.
Oh, infinitely cheaper. The amount of money we've given the Israeli military over the years, we could buy every Palestinian a parcel of land on the French Riviera.
That's about right.
Okay. So I want to thank Amber Anderson of North San Juan for a generous contribution, and also John from Carmichael. Thank you very much for a contribution. Few minutes left. Here's a wild one. Somebody just handed me a note. Does my guest have any advice for Xi'an voters? And that's X-I-A-N, which I believe is a province in China. Oh, wait. Okay, you might, because that is a Muslim area.
Yeah. No, I think what they maybe they really are like drawing a cross, and they mean Christian voters, Xi'an voters. That's how some people spell Christian, right?
Oh, okay.
So yeah.
Well,
yeah.
We'll let you answer that one.
Well, you know, as a Muslim, I would advise Christians to become better followers of Jesus, who is one of the top prophets. You know, he's as high a level prophet as it gets in Islam as well. So, and Jesus' teachings, in a way, are sort of the supreme, you know, perfect spiritual teachings. If you can really, you know, turn the other cheek and give up everything to follow God, to follow the truth, you know, that's what he was preaching. He said you have to give up your family, give up everything. You know, it's a real preacher of spiritual perfection. So I wish Christians would become better followers of Jesus and vote for politicians who are genuinely followers of Jesus' teachings, who are pacifistic, who are, totally given to love of their fellow human beings, to doing the right thing no matter what. I think it would be great if all of America's Christians actually voted for genuinely Christian candidates.
Okay. Kevin, we're about out of time. I want to thank you very much for being our guest today.
Well, thank you, Shamba. It's been a wonderful conversation, and you're doing a great job. There's so little radio where truth can be told like this. I hope your audience appreciates it, sends in their contributions, and keeps your operation afloat.
Thanks very much. And maybe we'll have you on sometime in the future where we can entertain listener call-ins and really roast your feet to the fire.
I look forward to that.
I'm sure you do. Kevin, have a great day, and thank you again.
Okay, thanks, Shamba.
Bye-bye. Okay, I'm joined in the booth by Program Director Steve Baker.
And I was just going to say,
put you on the right mic. Okay.
I was just going to say, where do you find these characters, Chamba? What an absolutely delightful 2 hours. And right now, folks, now you got me again, okay? 530-265-9555 or 800-355-5867. I've got several of his books available out there. And was there also a DVD?
The DVD is Naturae Carta, Jews Against Zionism.
Okay. And several of his books available. Or if you simply want to make a donation and say, hey, I appreciate the job that Chamba Lane, the kinds of folks and guests that he brings, and the viewpoint that he has, right now is your time to say thank you, Chamba, and by making a donation to the station that dares give this guy a voice. 530-265-9555 or 800-355-5867. Kevin I was almost dozing off at one point, but then he said he wanted to stop those people from dozing, and I just jolted right up, let me tell you.
Okay. One thing is that if you want all three, both of his books plus the DVD for $150 pledge, you can have all three books.
So the gift of $150, that's less than 50 cents a day, and you can have the entire package and show your appreciation and support for what Chamba did. Right now, the numbers to call are 530-265-9555 or 800-355-5867. And, of course, as we've said before, you can also do this securely online at kvmr.com. thankyougifts.org. If you'd like to hear about some other thank you gifts, the folks out there can tell you about them, everything from crank radios to KVMR umbrellas. And but right now we don't have any we don't have any of those fabulous Chamberlain 4-foot by 5-foot posters. They're due in any century now.
Oh, the full frontal nude posters. No, I think we ran out of them. They were terribly popular. one thing that I did mention at the very beginning is that I am offering an angel membership, and that is if you become a KVMR angel. $365, which is only a buck a day for the year, you can do a a rabble-rousing show. I'll engineer it, and you can have an hour, and you can do your own rabble-rousing. So for those of you incipient rabble-rousers out there, this is your chance. $365 donation, and you get to rabble-rouse for a whole hour on KVMR.
And don't worry, we'll have armed security in here for to keep a Chamba from you. So 265-9555 or 800-355-5867. A very nice comment here from John Gabriel. Anyway, he says he likes public affairs shows. He loves Chamba. And he really likes that that Chamba isn't pitching during his show. So there you go.
All right. Yeah, it's a decision I've made to try and keep pitching to a minimum, and so I want to give you as much information as possible, and I want to keep as much continuity. But that means that in order to support this show, now's the time. Now's the time for you to phone in your contributions. And actually, if you do so at any time during the pledge drive, and you feel that you want to mention rabble-rousing, please do so.
And